never forget the first moment when I walked in Kiwi Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On podcast, covering the week in film, Irish and international. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Donnacat.
Grace.
Ronan.
Jason.
And we'll be covering, as usual, the week in film news, the top 10, and the new releases. But let's start with what we normally do. So, Donica, what have you watched this week?
Well, this week, I'm really busy, so I haven't watched too much. I've watched one movie in the cinema, which I hope is in the top 10. So we'll save that for later, I guess. And I watched, on Netflix, I watched Happy Anniversary, which was okay.
Which is Happy Anniversary?
Happy Anniversary is it's like a two-hander with Ben Schwartz and Noelle Walls, who was in the first season of Master of None, and it's about a couple reassessing their relationship on their third anniversary, and it's fine. It's kind of a tonal mash and a bit of a tonal mess as well, but yeah, it's fine. It's a Netflix movie, so...
Is this in the mumblecore mold?
It's post-mumblecore, I guess.
More structured or less structured?
A little bit more structured. but definitely that's where its genes are, is sure. That kind of low-stakes... personal drama.
I like those generally.
Yeah, no, I'll go to bat for Puffy Chair any day of the week.
I actually haven't seen that. That's on my list.
Oh my goodness.
Cold Weather is the one I really like.
Oh, Cold Weather.
I like the one about beer, which I can't remember the name of.
Drinking Buddies.
Drinking Buddies.
Quite like that.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
quite good. But is Drinking Buddies really a mumblecore film?
That's almost gone mainstream.
Yeah, let's say
that's post mumblecore right there.
Cut that hipster. It's a mumblecore film.
It's ruining everything.
What's the one with the Duplass brothers, Jonah Hill, and Will Ferrell?
Jeff Who Lives in a Home.
That's Sarah Marshall. That's the guy from Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yeah.
Jason, whatever his name is.
Jason
Segel. There we go. I'm thinking of Begins with a C. It's about the boy who lives with his mother, who's Marissa Tomei. Marissa Tomei's marrying John C. Reilly.
Oh.
It was one of the Duplass brother movies that kind of broke through the mainstream.
I remember that.
But I love how many intimate details you remember, yet not the title.
Not the title. Something beginning with C. It's like Cyril or something.
Cyrus.
I got three of the letters.
I've actually seen that.
I love this new podcast format of a bunch of people trying to guess a movie
based on the description. That
audio
you have.
Charades.
Yeah,
that happens a lot.
It does.
And, it really does.
And then the other thing I'd like to talk about is Lemonade by Beyonce and loads of other directors and loads of other artists involved in that. I watched it again on Sunday morning and kind of was really just finished watching it just full of like the possibilities of art and expression. And, you know, I'm not a big Beyonce fan, but... That piece of film is just amazing. Like, really, really.
I'm a huge fan of it. Like,
one of your top 10, I think, in the year in question.
Yeah, I can never remember.
It was the year before last.
Yeah, it was my top 10.
Famously, the year that Jay decreed that O.J. Simpson Made in America was not a movie.
Yes.
What's
your point there?
Nothing, continue.
Because the Lemonade is terrific. It's beautifully shot. And there's so many directors that would have got to start there that I think Grace would work on things like Queen Sugar. I think we discussed and
the lifting from Daughters of the Dust.
Chef's kiss emoji. So that would have got started. I think the Lemonade would have went on to that show, and like the visuals are extraordinary, the music's amazing, and I was woven to it. It's really, really good.
And what I was so interested with, being someone who can contend with my own image, how I look like Beyonce is directing this and telling this story, but so much of it relies on just how stunning she looks as a person, and
she's framed,
and how everything about it is just like really kind of
a unique
piece of art, definitely. And that's all I've watched this week, unfortunately.
That's not a bad set at all. Grace, what have you watched?
I'm trying to think of how many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is a busy week for me.
Go for it.
That's more than me.
Two of which I've seen before, though, so they don't count. I saw Ocean's 8 last week.
We'll cover that, I think, in the new releases.
Okay, well, then we'll come back to it.
Sorry.
My opinion on it is positive. There's a Cliff's Notes version. Saw Independence Day at the Lighthouse for Jeff Goldblum's Day, which remains an iconic masterpiece, and I will punch anyone who says otherwise. That evening, then, I watched Set It Up on Netflix, which was a delight. I actually cannot believe how much I loved that film. I had zero expectations. But, well, I suppose I had some expectations because, like, I'd watched the trailer, but it looked like one of those kind of really just quirky, self-aware, yeah, like, you know, kind of standard issue type things. But it was just so good. The writing in it is electric. It's so knowing and witty and sharp, and it's all realized with this beautiful lightness of touch, and the leads are so charming. It's just a dream.
I think Netflix might be like finding its feet with romantic comedies, or maybe romantic comedies as well are finding Netflix.
The only people doing them, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's
just the thing. Someone made the point, I think, on Twitter that this is the type of film that if it was made maybe 10 or 12 years ago would have come out in the cinema and probably would have found a fairly solid following and probably made a lot of money. But these days, the audience for that is maybe not entirely on Netflix, but it's definitely the easiest way to reach that audience, because you're not going to be bumped out of the cinema after a week by whatever...
Behemoth comes in.
Exactly.
I mean, even in terms of romantic comedies. Yeah, the modern romantic comedies that you have tend to split across two lines. You have the indie romantic comedies in the style of, like, Obvious Child, for example, Jenny Slate,
which is
great, but has a sort of an indie edge to it, which this doesn't. And then you also have, like, the Chasing the Silver Dollar crowd, so we're talking about stuff like the Nancy Meyers, sort of, It's Complicated and stuff like that. The thing that I really liked about Setting Up is the fact that it is very much like a Nora Ephron mid-90s comedy, calling back to the 1940s, the point where one of the characters is a writer, and the other one looks like almost like a cartoon who's moving with his shoulders.
And the fact that they're in the same building and it's set up, it's so, like, stylistic. Yeah. Everything about it is just... Yeah. Like, it really kind of reminded me of something Nancy Meyers actually said about one of her scripts, where she was talking about how she visualizes the space before she writes a lot of the actual character work, because she needs to know where people are going to be in relation to each other for certain scenes. And that it made me think of something like that, where you think, like, this is the space where they are. How can we use it to the best possible... Like, how can we realize it in the best way? And it's just, there's an attention to detail in that that just seems so rare.
It's really accurate to that.
And lovely.
Like, it has, like, it's classic kind of situation-based kind of thing. Of, like, the office is almost like a living, breathing character, because it dominates everything, the work and the thing around it. So where do you meet, where do you think, where the setups happen, where it's kind of farcical things happen, where... Oh, I'll just go back and get this, and you find something, and it's the thing that kind of sets their second half in motion. All the kind of classic kind of tropes, but it almost feels radical in its old-fashioned kind of build-up. Like, that you've forgotten.
Well, it's a collection of, like, familiar rom-com tropes, right down to stuff like the use of New York City. I would argue this uses New York City better than one of the major releases this week, which should use New York City very well. This also has that sort of misunderstanding in the third act. It has characters who talk about, and this is kind of interesting for me, because it's a very conventional rom-com, but the characters talk about the romantic comedy tropes in a very self-aware way.
So you have,
for example, Harper talking about the Cyrano, which Charlie describes as the parent trap. And they use them both as verbs, Cyrano and parent trapping. But you even have later on, you know, the dicking around bit, where they talk about the inevitability in a romantic comedy of having to run at the climax no matter how well ahead of time you know the event is coming.
And he's like, oh, God damn it, I did it again. It's like,
and it is self-aware. It's not overly self-aware.
No, it's not just
self-aware.
It's just right. Smart about it.
Like. Yeah, it's just right. I quite enjoyed it. I did think that the score was a little bit too kind of like cutting room floor of like 90s rom-coms, where it's like, you know, no joke goes on, you know, unremarked or unsignposted, no sort of, you know,
There's one thing that particularly annoyed me about the score, actually, but this is a bugbear of mine in films for years, and there's a scene where Dire Straits' Romeo and Juliet is used, right, which is a fine scene and a fine song, but...
Is it?
I like it anyway, regardless. But the problem I have with it is that, and I presume it's down to editing, the song is not the song. So, like, you know, you have to first...
That bothers me so much.
First verse, and then skip to the first verse, because you've moved, like, the camera has moved, so you're into the third verse, then you're into the chorus, like, that is not the song, and I've seen somebody do it, and it kills
It's
me.
Like the musical version of, like, the action scene geography of Dublin, or whatever.
It's extraordinary. But it's essential.
Often you use a song for its key emotional cues, and to distort it, it's just...
It just takes you out of the
thing. Sometimes that can work really well. I mean, I was first exposed to God damn it. The Elton John song in...
Oh, we're doing this, hold on.
What?
Another round.
Yeah, we're doing it again. In Almost Famous.
Tiny Dancer.
Yeah. That, the version they sing in that same scene, which is iconic, is not the album version. And there's like a pre-chorus bit.
There's lots of stuff like that.
Yeah. I think
but how many songs over the years have you discovered and then looked them up and been like, this doesn't sound right?
Yeah. Why is there a bridge? Yeah. I don't want the bridge.
I don't necessarily have a problem with using a different version of a song, because it can often be quite an interesting comment.
Yeah.
There's one of the top 10 films that we're going to talk about, I'm sure, that does something like that. But when you take the well-known version of a song and chop it up, it just drives me crazy. Simon did this with Whitney Houston's one, Dance With Somebody, and I am not.
What?
I am not ready to forgive
you. You were not okay.
Oh, I was really upset.
And with because that song is a masterpiece.
That was personal. Carve it up. Yeah.
That was
personal.
Not I got up in the cinema and started dancing, and then they carved it up. I was like, what are you doing? You ruined the moment.
I shouldn't really kind of, because it's awful, but I remember P.S. I Love You, which is great.
Oh yeah.
But they actually
they do it to a Pogue song.
Were you?
Yeah.
Luckily, you only use, I think. But they use a Pogue song in their wake scene that they do exactly the same thing to. Yeah. It's unforgivable.
That film is offensive in every way.
Oh, no, it is. Yeah.
There's
some
bizarre
things
with
their accent, which is
weird.
Do
they sail from America and they wind up in Dublin or something?
I think you're mixing up
Leap Year. Also not great. No.
But Leap Year sort of transcends in a way that P.S. I Love You doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It's not Leap Year.
Leap Year, she walks from like Cork to Dublin pretty much, right?
It's transcendentally terrible. It's like United Passion's terrible. P.S. I Love You is just bad.
Yeah, it is. It's a bad
that's true.
It was a bad idea.
Kathy Bates.
We've really got all the hot takes here.
Yeah. P.S. I Love You. I've got more.
We're coming for you, 10-year-old.
I'll tell you, his girl Friday.
But yeah, no, I did really like Set It Up, actually. And I think you're right it's the Netflix niche. It's a great example of Netflix moving into... And this is the thing, because people are like, you know, what is Netflix doing, and they release so much crap. If they release 2 or 3 movies like this a year, I'm entirely happy.
Well,
they've been doing that a lot over the past while. Just kind of... I think they're just trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. Yeah. But in that, like Jay says, they're not that dissimilar from a movie studio. Yeah. They're just seeing which makes bank, so
I
to speak.
So.
And
then
put more money into
it. The kind of think piece is Netflix destroying cinema every week.
And I mean, rubbish that we have to listen to.
And I mean, there's also the argument that because you're paying only €8 a month and getting infinite access, it doesn't have to be as good as, say, going to the cinema, paying for a babysitter, paying for popcorn, paying for and so as a result, you get like Netflix has like it only has to do 2 or 3 really good movies a year to justify the cost you're investing in.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I'd highly recommend people. It's not perfect. In fact, it's very imperfect. There's a romantic comedy called Ibiza with Gillian Jacobs from Community.
Also heard, quite a lot of chatter about this.
It's a bit of a tonal mess, but there is some like the romance stuff doesn't work, but there is some genius comedy bits in it. And Vanessa Bayer is one of like the kooky best friends, and she's absolutely amazing in it. Really good.
You know what Netflix really needs to work on is better thumbnails. Because a bad thumbnail can turn you off
the
film instantaneously. And especially, you know, if you've seen the film already and then you see the thumbnail and you're like, I wouldn't watch this. Even though I know this is a good movie.
I don't mean to cast judgment on anybody at this table, but you know that they actually have like a rotating pool of 20 thumbnails that they target individually at users based on your past preferences. So they've looked at you and determined...
They're still showing me crap.
And they've looked at you and determined this is the best rating.
Even considering that, like, how is this one of the top 20 thumbnails is what I constantly find myself thinking.
But like, I mean, I remember for Set It Up, like, my thumbnail was Ty Diggs and Lucy Liu, and it's like, wow, they know what it gets like. It's like, I'm sold.
The day Annihilation came out, the thumbnail was like bad CGI teeth and the word Annihilation. I was like,
I just had the close-up of Natalie Portman with a gun, and I was like, that'll do it.
Good job, Netflix.
And then you click on it, and you get a bigger one, and it shows Tessa Thompson somewhere in the background, and you're just like, yep, also sold.
Guys, I didn't notice that. This is going to be fascinating, because I'm going to go home now and go through my thumbnails
and
I'm going to
explore.
It's like, that's what you think of me, Netflix? It's a strongly worded email.
I go to bat for you, and this is what you do.
Yeah. But anyway,
To move on, the other two films I watched were, I rewatched Lady Bird on Sunday, which is still a perfect, wonderful, sublime film. I love it. And we've spoken about it at length before, so I won't go into it too much. But we can talk more when Jay brings it up.
Yes.
And the other one I watched was Dude, which is also a Netflix movie on Sunday night. It's made by, it's written and directed by Olivia, I'm not sure how to pronounce her surname, Milch, I think. She's one of the co-writers of Ocean's 8. So I figured I'd give it a go because of Ocean's 8, and it's a bit of a mess. Like, it was, it's about four kind of female friends in their last year of high school, and then, like, something kind of happens near the start that impacts their behavior over the rest of the year. And I couldn't, it was one of those kind of curious things where I couldn't quite tell whether it was maybe bad casting or bad writing, which made it not knit together very well, because it was interesting. It had some, like, some notable things to say, but, like, they didn't start happening until about an hour into it, and then it was kind of just wrapped up in 20 minutes, so it's a weird one. But, you know, possibly worth a look, maybe with one eye.
I think you're right, it's interesting, though. I think you're right, particularly when you get, like, a four friends type setup.
Yeah.
It can be chemistry that's missing, or it can be...
I think it might have been, yeah, chemistry.
That kind of throw it off.
Yeah, and this also has that slightly, which is a little bit disappointing from a female writer, but it has that kind of awkward, like, I'm going to make this super authentic, so I'll have them, like, swear and smoke pot and talk about, like, bodily functions, which is fine, but it just doesn't ring true in this film, which I think might be the cast more so than the writing, but it is a little bit like, okay, we can move past this. We've established that this is the way they talk, now let's move on, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Noted.
But still, it's like, it wasn't terrible. It's worth a look. There's high praise.
And so, Ronan, what was your week like?
I had a slightly Frenchy week, I suppose. I went to the...
Always have Frenchy week.
No, I don't. I stand the French.
I mean, last week was a Romanian week, so...
There you go. I mix it up.
The continental week.
I went along to the IFI Killer Couple season and saw Louis Malle's Elevator to the Gallows, which is incredible.
It's great.
Yeah. And he made... It was his first feature made, I think, at the age of 27. It's one of those things... I don't get into this whole, you know, when somebody was my age... They were doing this thing because people tend to be better sometimes.
Yeah.
And Louis Malle is much better than most people I know, judging by this film. It's incredible. I could have happily watched 90 minutes of Jean Moreau walking around in the rain to the tune of Miles Davis. And I got a great film on top of it with this sort of incredible proto-noir plot.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's
It's pretty great.
Is this your first Malle?
No, I've seen a few. Oh, okay. I love The Fire Within. It's one of my favourite films. But I have, I suppose I haven't seen too many, but this one is...
Zazie Don LaMetro? Oh my god, it's joy. Absolutely joy.
Like, everything I've seen at this point has knocked me off my feet.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
This was really, really tremendous in the first fizz I've seen on the big screen. It's like the plot machinations are, it has this kind of incredible thriller structure wrapped up in this European art house atmosphere. And it's beautifully done and kind of often very funny in the sort of the difficulties that befall the characters. It's just so perfectly written. It's one of these great
another chef's kiss emoji.
Yeah, absolutely. I really, really enjoyed that, and I think that season's coming to a close now, but that was absolutely a highlight for me.
That's pretty great.
Caught a new release as well, also French, Jeune Femme, which is...
I missed this. I still haven't got to it. I think it's gone.
It's gone as of today, I think, which is a terrible shame for you, because
it's great. Yeah,
it's really fantastic. One of my favourite new releases of the years, and always plus, incredible cat. It has got such a cat.
Suddenly I'm interested.
Yeah. Oh.
You said cat?
I was a cat named George, yeah. Was it a cat named George? What was the one last year? There was the one that was based on the true story about the...
Oh, Bob?
Bob, there we go. A street cat named Bob.
Oh, right. Did we have a cat in here?
Yeah. No, never mind.
Great
year for cat movies.
Cam needs to start giving out a cat award, and it would immediately go to this. Cam did give this an award. It got the Camera d'Or, I think, in two festivals ago, and it really, really deserves it. It's a really impressive debut feature. As in, last year, 2017.
Oh, right. Jeez, okay.
You act as if that would be a surprise.
That's exactly my point.
Sometimes
it kind of takes sort of 18 months usually.
Yeah, by the time you get to see a movie, like, the conversation on it is over
it
and
feels
done
like
with,
it's a million years ago. Yeah.
True.
I was beyond impressed by this. It's got this kind of almost quite typical narrative of, it starts off with a woman who's just been broken up with, and she's hysterical in the streets of Paris, and it's very deliberately, I think, stereotypical about the way it does that, and then it slowly transforms that whole narrative on its head. And the thing it really reminded me of more than anything else is Let the Sunshine In. I think it would make a really great double bill with that, the two sort of French romantic comedies of the year that play around with the genre a lot. It's very, very likely to make my top 10 at the end of the year, the way things are going. I really, really love
it. I wonder if it's on VOD.
Yeah, yeah, you need to catch up with it.
I will.
I was floored. Watched a couple of things that we'll be talking about later, but the one thing I really, really loved this week, and it was one of those things where you revisit a film you've previously seen and you really, really liked the first time, and realise that, oh wow, it was even way better than I thought. Carl Black's Pigs from 84.
It's amazing.
Which I think may now be my favourite Irish film. Yeah, it really kind of...
It's incredible.
It's like, was I paying attention last time? Because I really liked it, but I didn't realise just how
it was. I think even when I watched it, I was very well aware that there's a lot to be digging into.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 380 minutes or something, but
yeah,
there's
yeah,
a lot in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's very... And it's available on Volta to rent for $2.99, and strongly advise anyone to go off and do that, because it is an absolute...
Nobody
had
the money to make
Irish
films in the 80s, and this is one of the few...
That's the thing, and it was supported by the then new film board. Who reputedly sort of got hold of it and were like, what have we done?
Because
it is,
isn't like anything.
By the standards of Irish cinema, it is incredibly bleak, which is saying something.
That's unusual.
It's very equivalent with these guys kind of living in a house that's kind of
They're in this old sort of Georgian mansion that is crumbling. It opens on a shot of like a burning streets and cranes up to crumbling houses, and you can see the wallpaper peeling within. It's incredibly dark, and it makes sense at the time. We just come off three general elections in 18 months, the country was in chaos, the unemployment rate was, you know,
it was not a nice time.
Ireland was
not
a nice
time,
I tell you that much.
And it's really incredible the way it plays around with that atmosphere, but with a great humour that I don't think I necessarily caught last time.
I did a little, but I suspect I'd find it funnier because I was too busy concentrating
as well. But there are a lot of little details going on in the background. At one point, you can sort of hear something vaguely going on the radio, and I dug into it. I was like, what is that he's listening to? It's an audiobook of 1984. year was released. There are all these little sly gags about actually Ireland is this terrible dystopia. And yeah, it's the way it captures that is incredible, and I think it's opening and closing shots are absolutely perfect bookends. It's the kind of thing where you come out of it going, that film was just perfectly structured. Knew exactly what it was doing the whole
way. I kind of stumbled upon it on Volta, and it was kind of, I think the picture you have, talking about thumbnails, the picture you have is like, oh, I want to see this.
Yeah.
I've never seen this. I've never seen this. I've seen Call of Duty Korea before, which I really liked.
Yeah, it was the same. I hadn't seen Korea
so
before.
So the only one because I'd seen. And so I stuck around kind of a late evening, and I was kind of riveted. I was like, good lord.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I imagine it would benefit from a kind of a HD release, because some parts are kind of hard to see, I remember.
It's very, very, very dark, tingy film. Shot by Thaddeus O'Sullivan. Who's going to become a director in his own right since.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. Well worth for £3. Like, it's...
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, I cannot recommend it enough.
It's good to see you going whole hog on this one.
Hey!
You've just been sitting on that.
Didn't want to intrude. I thought it would be rude. Jason, what have you watched this week?
We'll start with speaking of films that you watch a second time and can't believe how high in estimation it's gone up. I give you Lady Bird. I watched it for the second time last night. And
I
think
just feel like making that Olaf from Frozen voice, like, oh, I love it even more.
That's exactly it.
It makes me laugh.
Like, I loved it when I saw it. It's my favourite film of the year. I kind of let it sit for a few months just to kind of, you know, just a little bit of distance from it. So kind of, I was like, last night felt like a good night to kind of watch it again. And kind of, because you know what happens in the second time as well, so you can concentrate on the kind of incidental details. And you kind of, and we kind of talked about it a little bit, but it's good. It's a couple of things to note. There's one scene, and I think it's kind of one of the well-known scenes in it, I guess, where they're dress shopping, the mother and Lady Bird, and, you know, they're kind of arguing, then it's like, look at this, oh my god, it's perfect, you know, the but it's a scene after that, which lasts about 4 seconds, I think. It cuts, like, this film, there's not a second waste effect. It cuts to the mother kind of doing a bit of repair work on the dress at a spinning wheel.
Sewing machine.
She's
altering.
Yes.
Whatever they call those devices.
And then it does another quick cut, and she's in Lady Bird's bedroom, hanging the dress up, and she stands there looking at her for a couple of seconds, like, and it's the only kind of time she, you can see the kind of look on her face. It's the only time she can kind of express it, when she's not awake. And this lasts about four or five seconds, I'd say, mm-hmm. the whole sequence, and it tells you so much about the film in just that. And that there's a, probably about five or six that I identified similar mm-hmm. scenes that do that, and that's on top of everything else the film was. It's incredible. The camera work is beautiful.
It's so subtle and so graceful the way it does it. Like,
it is
graceful.
That's exactly the word for it. The editing is astonishing. It should have gotten nominated and won Best Editing, in my opinion, because it's seamless, it's quiet, it doesn't call attention to itself, but it adds so much to the film.
Like, there's so much attention to detail in it, though. Like, I think the fact, like, those scenes that you mentioned, and there's a couple of other moments with the mother, Marion, where, like, you see the entire film essentially the way Lady Bird sees it. You see it through her eyes very much, and the only time that perspective is interrupted is when you see a moment of just her mother on her own.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly telling, because that is the only insight you get into, like, a perspective other than her own. And it says so much about Lady Bird herself.
I think the scene at the start where she, well, not kind of relatively early on the film, where she asks, like, did you not have a moment where you didn't tidy your room and you didn't do whatever? Mm-hmm. She's like, my mother was an abusive alcoholic and left the room, just the door. And it's like, oh my God. It's like, it's just conversation ender, like, but it's also tells you familial history and variation, because depression hangs over this film. It's like it's low key affects a handful of people. The dad, the priest, the lovely older priest,
that moment, I burst out crying
when he starts crying. He apologizes and he puts hands and his shoulders. He's like, sorry, it's one of those things.
It's the perfect combination of hilarious and heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
And I just lost.
And the interesting scene as well, which I loved, and weirdly, I forgot. I actually, like, this is a spoiler, obviously, if you haven't seen it, but if you haven't seen it,
you are wasting your life.
But,
pause the podcast, go watch the movie, come back and listen to Jen.
But Lucas Hedges, is it? Hedges didn't sound right. His character is gay, but I'd forgotten his character was gay. Like, I'd completely forgotten that. Because the film definitely sets it up, like, how it's plays out when you find out. But it's the scene where he goes to visit her and he talks about it outside the back of the coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And the scene starts off like every scene of that type you've seen in every film of that type you've seen before. But the kind of sympathetic and empathetic characterization and direction pushes the film, pushes the character's joy of what happens next. And it's a beautiful scene. Like, and it doesn't last long again, because there's no time wasted. This is done within 40 seconds, like 50 seconds. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's held just the right amount of time as well. Like,
I think that kind of scene is crucial, because it appears on the surface to be almost incidental, but what it does is create the sense of these characters slowly recognizing what's going on
and growing
beneath the facades they show to each other and realizing that
so much of that in it.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's what I really
coming
like
to appreciate what's going on with these people that you sort of only relate to in an angry way.
And I think that's such a lovely, like, the whole film does this, but I think that in particular is such a lovely evocation of, like, the female gaze in one sense, because you're seeing everything the way Lady Bird sees it, but you're also seeing all of the detail that she's slowly gathering that doesn't make sense to her at the moment, but later, like, with more time and perspective, she will figure out why it was so important at the time. And I love the way it does that. It's so subtle but so telling.
Like,
I think
moments of minor epiphany that may not even be recognized later. And I think that it's interesting the way that's filtered through the perspective of Gerwig, who's obviously looking back on this, and that's why it rings so true.
The fact that, like, she doesn't need anybody else to tell her that these things are important, she's noticing it all herself, even if she doesn't register why.
But even as a director, Gerwig's not going to call attention to like, there's so many directors that call attention to big capital letters, important points in the film to really signpost, in case you've missed it.
I'm trying to imagine, like, that
first film as a director, like, to do
That last phone call that she makes to her mother, like, in the hands of a lesser writer, would be destroyed.
And
like, you can actually just imagine how somebody would ruin it. But instead, it's this incredibly short conversation. And it's not even a conversation. She's leaving a message.
It's
like three or four lines.
Which shows her direction skills.
And
like
a little flashback. And just
that cut between the two of them driving is incredible. Like, it's really beautiful and pulls everything together into the way it should be. Like, it's...
I'm getting emotional just thinking about it.
It's one of the best films this decade, I think, and it's weird because this is the second film I've given 5 stars in 6 months. I'm becoming Father Christmas of films here.
I honestly, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm actually going to the doctor tomorrow. That's how worried I am.
I really loved it. You're making me want to watch it again.
You should. It's right up there for the decade for me. It's incredible.
And I think there's enough little details like that in it as well that every time you watch it, you will pick up something else.
I could watch it again tonight. Like, honestly, but...
Go for it.
I
go.
We're never going to go to dinner.
Come on. Five stars, Jay. We just want you to be happy.
I know. I want me to be happy.
Watch Lady Bird tonight.
Maybe. What if this is the best version of First Like a Bee? That'll finish.
I'd settle for that.
Me too. We talked about setting up, so I won't mention it, except it's really, really good. And you're going to watch Streets of Fire, which Thank you, Ronan.
I have bullied you two into watching
this. I didn't bully us.
It doesn't take much bullying.
Aggressively
this film has an incredible
I think you had me with like Willem Dafoe leather vampire, and I was like, I'm in. It's done.
Bizarre, low-cut leather dungarees. Yeah.
It's really brilliant.
It's great.
What an outfit. That's coming out of fire. Of course.
If I was if I ever dressed up on Halloween, that's where I'd wear. But I never do. But if I did,
I'm going to keep an eye out for somebody like this at Comic Con.
And you know what?
Like, where is the William Dafoe?
And
the hair.
Is it Wes Anderson has described how it's surprisingly difficult to make William Dafoe look threatening, because apparently he's quite short in person.
Yeah.
So for directors, and it's a credit to both William Dafoe and the directors he's worked with, that he looks consistently threatening.
Yeah.
He's often very terrifying.
The interesting thing is, I was saying to Ron, I would really want to see it in 35mm.
The colours.
Pops. Yeah, exactly. But so Hollywood Babylon had a double wheel with this and the Terminator not long ago. I was like, God damn
that
it.
You mean the one program. Good James Cameron film, Jay?
Yes, I mean the one good James Cameron film, Darren. But the Streets of Fire is great. The 50s, 80s mashup.
It's the neon 80s nightmare of a gonzo 50s sort of dystopian
nightmare part bonkers story that kind of goes all over the place.
Walter Hill has said he made exactly the film he would have wanted to watch as a 15-year-old boy, and there are very few people who could make that and not have it be intolerable.
That's probably correct. And the colours, oh my god, the colours.
The colours, the music, the energy, the vibe,
the music.
Dynamism.
I watched this, I think, 3 weeks ago.
It opens with a concert performance.
And closes.
Which is extraordinary.
And the song it closes on is genuinely great. Yeah. I have been listening to it non-stop cycling around the city for 3 weeks. I feel like I could take on anything.
So if you're crossing a road and you hear the sound of the Streets of Fire soundtrack approaching.
For some reason, every time you say the title, I keep thinking of I'm on Fire by Bruce Springsteen, which is not quite...
No, this is more Born to Run than Bruce Springsteen.
Because there is a Springsteen thing to it.
It was meant to have a Springsteen song in it, and then they wanted to do something that Springsteen wasn't happy with, so they took it out, and it's still just called that.
Could you wear these leather cutoffs, Mr. Springsteen?
And I'm very happy that they didn't, because it meant that they had to make the soundtrack they did, which is, I genuinely think, one of the greatest soundtracks.
The cast is amazing as well. The cast is really fantastic. Rick Moranis in a small supporting role. Diane
Strangest
role.
Yeah. Madigan is great.
And the what's his name?
Another
back
one.
I know. Agent Johnson from Die Hard is one of the four singers, and so is what's his name? He was in Forrest Gump. He was Bubba. Makita Williams.
It's a great cast. It's a great film. It's as much fun I've had watching a film. And I can't remember when.
And that's the thing, it's joyous. Just unashamed fun. It is. It's a sugar rush of a film.
What's it actually about?
It
starts off with this amazing.
Teddy boys are coming for your girlfriend. But one of them is Willem Dafoe, and he's a leather vampire.
I didn't understand that. So.
It starts
is he actually a vampire?
No, he looks like one.
Lads.
It's a concert that's performance that lasts like 6-7 minutes. And a gang of bikers run in, steal the singer off the stage, and her boyfriend is roped in to bring her back.
Her ex-boyfriend.
Kind of man with no name, quite quiet.
It's very strange, all the sort of genre influences going on.
It's a bit of everything in it, but it coalesces unbelievably well. You think it couldn't possibly, but it really, really does. It's like, oh my god,
the 80s
is
the only decade, presumably, that could have created this.
In terms of Walter Hill, it is the 80s equivalent of The Warriors.
Yeah.
The Warriors is the 70s.
Is it right after
The
Warriors?
It was a couple years later, I think.
It was after 48 Hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was right after 48 Hours.
It's
the same writer-producer team. They basically were given carte blanche and they made this, which is
amazing.
Okay, I really need to check.
It's really incredible. The 50s were still influential, weirdly, so I had this kind of weird 50s, 80s.
Well, I mean, you want to look at like Reagan and the appeal back.
But it's the same as Blue Velvet,
Blue Velvet,
the 80s, and
Nightmare on Elm Street, even. Yeah,
but this
is
much more fun than those. This is glorious.
Is Blue Velvet not meant to be so much fun?
Jay sitting there pumping his fists in the air to Blue Velvet.
I mean,
But what I really love about it is that there, you know, there's a lot of violence and explosions and all the rest. It's PG. And
it's like
everyone,
A-team violence and explosions. Yeah,
everyone behaves like a child, and you know the
even when they abduct the singer, Willem Dafoe is like the almost the perfect gentleman aside from tying her to a bed. Like, yeah, almost a perfect gentleman.
Yeah. I love women.
Like, I mean, if you wrote a Me Too think piece on Willem Dafoe in this movie, you get at least half the population going, "It was just a bad date."
That's true.
Plus, can we say like, it's a really,
to be clear,
really,
that was satire before the internet comes to me. Like, okay,
it's just the letters are coming.
Yeah.
It's also, for bonus points, 93 minutes long.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's a great,
anything under
100
minutes gets an extra star.
Yeah, it does. And I'll finish just by saying I watched Deep Impact, the Mimi Leader film, which is so great. It's one of the better blockbustery disaster films. In fact, it's probably the best one of the last whatever.
It is very good.
What's about 98, 20 years? Yeah.
Jay.
It's right. What are you going to say? What are you going to counter with?
Grace literally just watched Independence.
That was from earlier though, wasn't it?
Independence Day is, I believe, 1996.
96,
yeah. I think of Freddie Pinback. But I do like Independence Day.
I love Independence Day so much.
And all the Tony Scott films. And obviously, like,
yes,
The
this
Rock.
This is a disaster film there.
Okay. Yeah. Deep Impact is fab, though.
It is.
It's really, really good.
Great characterization.
Great cast.
A lot of
attention to the human story. Yeah. And the way it feels a lot more believable in the way it unfolds, too. Than its sister giant asteroid movie.
Yeah. Given its sister film has Steve Buscemi riding a nuke, I feel like, you know.
There's like the America version of this and the rest of the world.
Hey. No, Deep Impact's great. And the characters are great. The comets look like cost about 50 cent. They're really bad, unfortunately. You haven't stood up the test in time.
It's okay, only one of them hits us.
Yeah, but
spoiler!
The effects generally are actually pretty good. It's the comments just like somebody just kind of drew on the screen a little bit.
And it has a little baby pre Lord of the Rings Elijah Wood.
Yes, it does.
Which is
and
Steve Downey,
who is fantastic.
Yeah. And James Cromwell and Morgan Freeman. It's got a fantastic.
Yeah, let's talk about Morgan.
Yeah, okay.
Darren.
Yeah, after my previous comment.
Morgan's
like,
out there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only part that we kind of didn't like. But that's me for the week.
Well done.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Good job.
I somehow watched 7 films last week, but most of them are either in the top 10, have already been covered by the people here, or in the new releases. So I'm going to hit you with the two I've seen that I can talk about. First one of them is Peter Bogdanovich's 1973 Paper Moon, starring Tatum and Ryan O'Neal.
Oh, yeah, hallelujah!
It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is terrific.
We had Luke on a little while ago talking about What's Up, Doc. This is like the third of that sort of wonderful triptych from the last picture show through What's Up, Doc to this, where you have that sort of nostalgia for old Hollywood cinema. Obviously, Bogdanovich had started out as a critic, then studied as an actor, and then sort of developed into a writer and director. And this is beautiful. It's a film that is set during the Great Depression about a con man who gets roped into escorting what may or may not be his daughter on a road trip across the Depression-era United States. It's incredible. It's charming. It's fun. It's witty, it's well observed. It's got that wonderful mid-70s thing going on where people are like, okay, what is a nuclear family now? In very much in the sort of like, in what we now associate with the Fast and Furious way. It's about family. But it's this idea that what makes a family is not a biological link. It's much more, it's a found family.
Yeah.
It's the idea of who you end up with. And so you have this weird sort of situation where a father who has never been a father to this girl somehow becomes a mentor figure to her while she becomes a caregiver to him. They rope in a prostitute / exotic dancer who becomes part of this sort of weird like nuclear family unit that travels across the country. It's fantastic. It's beautifully written. It's wonderfully performed. Great sense of humor. And just really clever all around. It's a fantastic film. I wholeheartedly recommend that you seek it out if you haven't already. It's probably my favorite Bogdanovich film, but I am not overly mad on Last Picture Show. But that's because I'm a cold cynic with no heart.
Yeah.
That is also true. And on that note, very quickly, because I literally just watched it the week before and coincidentally found myself watching it this week, The Prestige, which is... yes.
Coincidentally, I
know, what are the
watching.
This was
actually
not
watching it now.
Right now.
Playing on a constant loop in his head.
Inside my head. I'm doing the film is. Yeah, now this was not by my choice, but given that we'll talk about it, it's very simple. It's part of...
Whose choice was it?
Fates. Fates,
the little angels on his shoulders going, you haven't watched any Nolan today.
Yeah, But yeah, so basically I came out of a random number machine, and so I had to actually watch it. That's the reason. That's the story that I'm sticking to. But yeah, it continues. It's fascinating. One of its more under-discussed attributes is the way in which it serves as part of Nolan's exploration of late capitalism, along with Inception and also The Dark Knight Rises, this sort of ambivalence about how modern society sort of corporatizes people and how it reduces them to commodities and material objects. In fact, the whole point of The Prestige is that there is this person from a lower income background who has a unique attribute who tries to leverage that into ascending through the class structure. And also then this rich industrialist upper class gentleman sees this, is so enraged by the fact that he cannot commercialize or commodify this, that he sets about breaking the very laws of nature itself in order to mass produce this one unique attribute about an individual, and in doing so does something monstrous, horrific, and destroys the fabric of reality itself. It's brilliant. So yeah, The Prestige as a Marxist tract by Christopher Nolan.
I respect you enough to watch it, just maybe not this week.
One day. I'm going to keep watching it until you do, Robin.
Oh, no.
But anyway.
What have I done here? I'm going to have to intercept and plant something in Karen's head to tell them he hates Christopher Nolan.
I'm holding the DVD Blu-ray right to my head right now. But anyway, let's move on to talking about the news, the latest news in the world of film. So yeah, the Irish Film Board has changed its name to Screen Ireland this week.
Fish Aaron.
Yeah. Which is an interesting choice. We've talked about this in the podcast before, but it's basically seems to be an effort to rebrand in a way to like basically adopt the various ways that people watch media now, where it's no longer just watching on screen, it's also television, but it's also laptop, it's also phone and stuff like that. So it's an interesting choice.
I'm in favour of everything they're saying in terms of broadening the definition and all the rest. You know, you talked about Twin Peaks earlier and the furor over that. I like this, but I am deeply concerned about not seeing the Irish Film Board little reel in cinemas anymore. I like that, with the three people standing up in perfect succession.
And
that's a great comfort.
Well. Yeah, the little queue. I wonder, are we going to have to... Yeah. When will they start rolling it out? I mean, presumably the films that are in post-production now, so obviously like Kissing Candies this week, and obviously Dublin Old School next week, will still have the old Irish Film Board logo. I wonder when we'll start seeing the Fish Aaron logo in front of...
Probably in front of Lenny's, maybe, is
the deal. Okay. That would probably be
Stranger.
When is that due out?
It's an autumn kind of release.
Is it not autumn? I thought it was the late... Yeah, okay, it is autumn, but it's like September, October, because it's a horror movie as well. It's The Little Stranger.
Yeah.
It should be.
It makes more sense to do on a high
based on a book by the same woman who wrote the book The Handmaiden is based on.
That's true.
That's what has me interested.
Yeah.
Perfect. In other news, Film Mayo has set up an application for its residency award, so it's looking for a writer.
Film Mayo?
Yeah. Not that anybody at this particular table might be interested in this, but
what
they are...
make me move back to Mayo? No.
Steady,
Christ,
and,
no.
And we're out. Okay. But yeah, so basically they've set up an application. They set up a program to encourage writers, filmmakers in residence in Mayo with the support of the local film authority, which would include... basically, the residency would be from September through December for this year. €6,000 award?
Week?
No, unfortunately for the entire
Mayo for £6,000 a week.
Okay, Film Mayo, you heard that.
You
heard that here.
You can make £6,000 go a long way in Mayo, too. Believe me.
Yeah. I could be the king of Mayo.
Well, we were talking about what you would do with €2,000 to make a film in Dublin. I'm just imagining if you went down to
make
Mayo.
Make it in Mayo.
You went down to Mayo with £6,000. You come back with like Apocalypse Now.
Plus, to be fair, Mayo is, I would argue, a cinematic, in inverted commas, county, because it is very visually and aesthetically stunning, and there is absolutely nothing to do there. So there is nothing to stop you going out and focusing entirely on your art.
But it does. Like the West of Ireland is an absolute, as somebody else from the West of Ireland, it is, as you can tell from my accent, it is entirely beautiful. It's fantastic.
Just like you can tell I'm from Mayo from mine.
But it
that's what we do. Just get rid of the accents.
There are no standard West of Ireland accents. But yeah, it's absolutely beautiful, scenic, and obviously Black 47 is a literal Irish Western. So there is a lot of stuff you can do out there. But included within the grant and within the residency is the Yves Balana Arts Centre facilities, community engagement, 15 hours of mentoring from panel including an unspecified screenwriter, director and producer, and also 2 weeks in the Tyrone Guthrie Centre in County Monaghan in 2019 as well. So you can apply online via the Film Mayo website if you're interested, if you have a sort of a project that you would like to see developed, or if you have a creative vision that you'd like to see them or you'd like to help realise with their assistance.
Alright, sounds interesting.
That's good,
Tell them I sent you.
Okay. Where's he going with this?
All right. Also, the IFI is launching a Dark Skies invasion, alien invasion movie season.
Very
yes,
very excitingly, because they have Starship Troopers.
I'm going to see that. Is what I'd say if I was going to see that.
Thank you, Jay.
But I'll be in Galway, so I've been looking to see that. So,
is that on during
the fly? It is unfortunately overlapping with the fly.
Oh, God, I've got a ticket already.
Oh, no.
But yeah, they're the
highlights. You can just come back up for it.
Yeah, that's true.
The highlights include Starship Troopers on 35mm, Aliens on 70mm, and Mars Attack.
I'm also
on
going to that.
And
Mars Attack's great as well.
Mars Attack is fantastic. I like the pointed exclusion that you're making there, Jay. You would love to see Starship Troopers. Mars Attack is fantastic. What about the other 70mm screen that's showing? Yeah. Perfect. Also showing is War of the Worlds, Attraction, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and The Thing.
Which version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers is it?
It is the 1956.
That's the older one.
Oh, no, sorry.
And likewise with the...
Oh, no, it is. It's the 1978. You're right.
It's the older one. With the older thing, is it?
It's not.
That's called The Thing from Another World. This is the John Carpenter version, which is fantastic.
I saw that in the Lighthouse midnight, on the late night screens last year.
Wait, The Thing? The Thing.
The Thing.
The actual thing.
Yeah,
like the Kurt Russell thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I didn't know they were showing that.
Oh, that's cool.
I got that for $2.50 last week, secondhand. I was feckin' delighted with myself.
Good work. That's really nice. Good work.
I wanted to get Tombstone, and they could not find the disc, so...
That really hurts when that happens.
I was very sad. I thought, look, I have a copy of Tombstone.
They have put the discs in the thing.
No, it's one of those secondhand places where they keep it behind the counter, so that you don't just pick it up.
I know people are going to go in there and try to steal it.
Yeah, also because it was Tala. Not to stigmatize Tala at all.
Oh, it happens in the city as well.
Grace is on fire today. First Mayo, now Tala.
I hate everywhere I live.
Put in with your places and Grace will tear them asunder every week on the podcast.
And then finally, in other news, the Galway Film Fla, which is happening very soon and overlapping, as we pointed out, with that Dark Skies Festival. The Film Fla has announced 3 masterclasses, one with Andrew Scott, one with Madeleine Olnick, and one with Ed Solomon as well. They've also announced that the opening film will be The Belly of the Whale by Morgan Bush, which looks interesting.
Nothing about this except Pat Short's in it. He is in 33% of all orders.
Statistically speaking. Statistically speaking.
I'm sure if Niall were here, he would get very upset if you said that.
Well, I mean, was it after the... And again, I know that Ronan has mandated a no sports on this podcast discussion. Correct. After
when did we... We did not take a democratic vote on that.
Apparently, that's not how it works. In the spirit of FIFA. But yeah, after the Spain and Portugal match, they showed the flag on Network 2, which was interesting.
I haven't seen the flag.
You just called it Network 2, though.
Oh, 90s nostalgia, ladies
Vintage.
And gentlemen. Perfect. But yeah, the Belly of the Whale is about a child who leaves foster care, basically, and tries to connect with one of his old friends. He gets caught up in hijinks and misadventures involving burning down the friend's caravan. And basically,
hijinks.
Yeah.
And when is that screening, actually?
That screening
it's the
is
Tuesday,
on the
half seven,
night
I think.
At seven,
okay.
Yeah,
I'm
seven
going to go Thursday, so...
Oh, okay.
As ever, the flag is doubling down, refusing to be in any way anything other than an incredibly Irish festival, which is what I love about it. Yeah. That you know, they resist certain other festivals in this country of going for larger red carpet premieres and really focus on the Irishness of things.
To be fair, it has a really good cast outside of.
Oh no, I'm not, denigrating the film in any way or saying it's a lesser work, but there are a lot of festivals that would try to bring in some sort of international element to open the festival and. The Fly has no interest in that. That's what I like about it.
Ooh. It also stars Louis McDougall from A Monster Calls and Pan, and also Michael Smiley as well.
Smiley is always welcome.
Perfect. So that in mind, then we will move on to talking about the top 10 at the Irish box office this week.
Excitement.
Everybody's favourite part of the podcast, particularly those sitting around this table.
But The Greatest Showman isn't in there
at
anymore.
At least one thing.
You know that the Greatest Showman was still the second highest performing film in Dundrum last week.
Isn't it like still the best selling album at the moment?
Yeah, it's number one
amazing.
In the charts. It's astounding. But it's not in the top 10, so we're not going to talk about it.
Guys, I need to make a revelation here.
Okay.
I haven't seen The Greatest Showman.
Oh, you're
nobody at this podcast.
We have repeatedly worried that none of us have seen it. We're the only people.
I just figured eventually you talk about it so much. I figured like
and yet we never got somebody on who would see it.
I think that's our kind of our bit. None of us
let's
are
talk
ever
about
see
movies
it.
That we've never seen.
At this point, we've talked about The Greatest Showman for the length of The Greatest Showman.
That's
I have it on Blu-ray. I'm hoping to watch it this weekend. It is also still in cinemas. It was actually screening in
they just brought it out anyway.
Yeah. They might as well. It was also screening in the Savoy. I was there for a premiere on Thursday, and in screen six, yep. The Greatest Showman was
also
still screening.
Also, next week it's 10-year anniversary screening to start. So, you know, we can look forward to those.
But yeah, so The Greatest Showman is not technically in the Irish top 10 at the moment, but that's Race 3. Is, which is a Bollywood film which earned €17,000, directed by Remo. Yeah, which is pretty good. It's always good to see that. This is the one that I think was only screening in three screens in Dublin and still managed to break the top 10.
Quite well, though.
It's a really high per screen average.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you've got a community here as well, it sort of serves them very
much so.
At number 9, Super Troopers 2, which we talked about last week in the new releases. I'm actually.
Did we?
Yeah. Obviously,
no,
it made quite an impression.
Anything
yeah.
about this film?
This is the obviously it's the sequel to the original Super Troopers, but it's a story about the Highway Patrol, I believe, in the U.S. But sure. In this case, they find that their town, border town, has been rezoned as part of Canada, and so have to make adjustments appropriately. Starring such Canadian celebrities as Rob Lowe and Linda Carter.
If they had any nerve, they would have done that at the Mexican border for political
Well, I mean, I feel it's more like the established premise of Super Troopers is that they're on the Canadian border.
All right.
It would be very difficult to rezone like a North Dakota
town. I have never seen Super Troopers or known zero.
I only learned what a Super Trooper is the other day.
I thought it was an episode.
Is it a real
thing? Yeah, I was about to say.
From somebody else who also didn't know what it was.
I thought it was just like a film. Is it a real thing?
Apparently it's some form of light.
Oh.
Like
what?
Yeah, apparently it's some kind of light. Like I don't know exactly what kind of light, but this is what they're referencing in the ABBA song. I just assumed it was some form
of police
person.
But I thought
the dance
move was marching. My ABBA knowledge, obviously, not as much as I thought it was.
Unless this person who... This wasn't a YouTube video. This wasn't a person saying it to me. They might have been misinformed, but I was like, really?
So it's great to see that. Belong
now,
to like
we're all googling it.
Yeah. The subgenre of songs about nightlights, along with Birdhouse in Your Soul, which is my personal favorite song about nightlights. But anyway, So at number
that's eight on that
transition, sort of subgenre.
It's a series of spotlights used in stadium concert and special event lightings.
Oh,
there you are. And it's spelled T-R-O-U-P-E or so.
Like a troop. I get it.
Would you like to know more?
On 35mm in the IFI on the 13th of July. At number 8, Avengers Infinity War.
Still going.
Still going.
Still
haven't managed to see it a second time.
€4.7 million at the Irish box office alone. Quite an accomplishment. Do you want to know what else is still an accomplishment?
Gnomes.
Sherlock Gnomes.
And
Gnomes, no
bells. Oh, I like it. And we're not going
to
top that.
It's just an excuse to do puns.
It is.
Every week.
Yes.
We're not going to top that, so we're going to move on to number 6, which is Show Dogs.
Yeah. Okay.
Indeed it is.
And moving on, at number 5, Deadpool 2.
This is
still
all
hanging on.
Deadpool 2 is holding out better than Avengers, because they both came out roughly the same time.
I believe
it
was a 2-week gap.
I think Deadpool came out a couple of weeks later.
There was a 2-week gap.
How's Deadpool doing totally?
Deadpool is currently on 2.2 million so far, so it's about half the way that Avengers was. But what's interesting is, as we noted last week, is Deadpool 2 seems to be hanging on better than Solo. It was number 2 last week, I think, whereas Solo was at number 3, which is...
Yeah, I do feel like poor Solo is being buried.
Oh, don't worry. I suspect we'll have a lot to talk about when we land on Solo, which is right now because it's number 4. Yes, Solo and Star Wars fans.
I just saw that tweet, by the way.
Yeah.
The one that you shared earlier, and I was just like,
Star Wars fans are trying to remake... Well, Star Wars
Why
fans
are
trying to remake
like
The
them?
Last Jedi by looking for really good investors to come in and pay for a remake to do it right.
You know there's going to be some sad, rich tech bro who'll probably give them the feckin' money to do it as well.
Yeah. Well, apparently they already have a board of producers that have agreed to pony up the money and are now crowdsourcing ideas on how to make Last Jedi better, and it's fantastic. You should actually just go on like online and read the comments from Star Wars fans.
I have too much respect for my eyeballs.
I like the sound of that. Bring the money, crowdsource the ideas.
Yeah.
That's a nice flip.
There was a thread someone was kind of talking about Leia being in love with C-3PO
We're in the fan fiction era, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but I mean,
I don't understand why these people can't just read fan fiction. Like, what's wrong with them? That's what fanfic is there for.
$200 million worth of fan fiction.
I have to say, I fully support this because it'll keep them busy for quite some time.
It'll take them long enough to figure out how to set up the camera.
What I don't understand is why, like, there's other stuff, guys. Like, move on. Yeah. Like if Star Wars...
There's actual Nazis.
Have you heard of Star Trek?
Yeah, but, like there's a lot of nerd stuff.
Oh, Star Trek has its problems,
But, yeah, like, I mean, I'm not big on the Marvel movies, and comics were really important to me as a kid, but just move on. Like, there's other stuff.
There's a lot of media there.
There's a lot of content.
Sometimes things aren't good for you.
But hey, yeah, I feel like directing them onto Star Trek may not be the best idea given what's happening in its own fan base.
We could direct That's kind of like a lateral space.
Lateral slash downwards move, yeah.
There's a sequel to it, you know.
Sequel to what?
But Streets of Fire.
Ah.
But by all accounts, no.
Oh, okay. So leave the original untouched.
You crushed me there.
So hold on.
The old Roman crush.
It was made about 4 years ago.
If we were to give you $200 million, could you make a better sequel to Streets of Fire?
Absolutely.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's get on this. Let's get this going. But yeah, okay.
You can set up a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's remarkable. Apparently, Star Wars, or the Lucasfilm, have basically stopped production on their separate spin-offs. In response to the failure of Solo, they're doubling down on they're doubling down on the Ryan Johnson trilogy, and they're doubling down on episode 9. Sorry,
I was just like, wait a minute, have they revoked the Ryan Johnson trilogy? No,
that's the thing that's definitely happening. They've killed the Boba Fett movie, which is probably a good idea, and also the Obi-Wan Kenobi movie. With
but like those two ideas were utterly preposterous. Like nobody wants those films at all, and like nobody wanted Solo, which admittedly I really enjoyed. Like I really liked it, but nobody actually wanted or needed it. If you were going to make a prequel about any of the characters in the original trilogy, why would you not make one about Leia? A princess turned senator turned rebel hero turned general, like, what the hell is wrong with you? There's scope for like five different genres there, and you can just cast Ellen Page. It's right there.
And Ronan is sold. Ronan is looking back in blockbuster cinema for 2019.
Also, like, they kind of ruined Leia with the whole End of Rogue One thing anyway, with that on Calibali.
Yeah.
Which really, really irked the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm the target market, like, you know, I'm aware of that. But good lord.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that digital de-aging, but it would have been nice if they just had, like, a younger actress like Ellen Page. Just play it for, like, one scene.
You realize this is, like, the template. They're basically doing this to figure out if they can get Robert Downey Jr., like, CGI for the next 50 years.
They already tried that, though, didn't they? At the start of, was it?
Civil War.
It was Civil War. Yeah.
We're moving into a Congress future.
But.
But I mean, in one sense, I suppose them not pulling Rian Johnson trilogy is a nice kind of F you to everyone who is up in arms over The Last Jedi. But also, The Last Jedi was not particularly good, so they would seriously want to put someone on him who can.
I think it was pretty
great. Do something about that.
I don't know. I kind of think it was pretty great, actually.
No,
I have a lot of time for anything Rian Johnson does, but with
I thought I did until I saw The Last Jedi.
With these cancellations, does that mean Colin Trevorrow is back off the case?
Well, he's now on Jurassic World 3. And do you not hear about this?
Didn't we all hate him?
Well, talk.
He not a thing?
I'm still hating.
I can't keep that. Don't worry, I'm sure that we'll have cause to talk about that later on the top 10. At number 3, it's Book Club, which I haven't seen.
I haven't got to yet. As I said, I will be in Cork this weekend, and there are some cinemas who are showing it there that I actually enjoy frequenting, so I'll probably catch it there.
I think you mentioned taking family members hostage and going to see Book Club.
Hostage? My mother might like it, and she's a handy excuse for me to go. Not that I need an excuse, it's Diane Keaton drinking wine and eating weird-looking salad, you know? Absolutely. What more very much my brand.
Perfect. At number 2, new entry, Hereditary.
Hereditary.
Oh, I'm just going to close my ears because I haven't seen it yet. I don't want to know anything.
We won't go into anything. Hereditary, I really liked for a long time until I really didn't for a little time. It's a lot of people keep like flagging the key influences, and I think really it's just sort of 1973 repackaged between Don't Look Now, The Wicker Man, and The Exorcist. Those are the three really, really strong influences, and I thought together with Rosemary's Baby, of course. It's when it's good, it's so good that I was really disappointed when it wasn't. because it has, you know, very high heights to fall from. But I do think it's very, very well directed. There are moments in it, there's one moment in particular in the first act that completely took me by surprise in a way that I haven't been in a cinema for a very long time. I was genuinely very, very impressed by it, and I thought, so much potential here, and it carries that out for a long time, but then drops the ball, I think. And it doesn't drop it terribly. It winds up being a perfectly good film, and this is what I was talking about. It has an incredible closing credits because it plays a great song, and I left the cinema singing, which was weird
for a horror movie.
Very impressed as well, by the way, that it has maybe 2-3 traditional jump scares in there, all of which work because they're soaked in atmosphere and all the rest. And it's very creepy at different points. There were moments where I was sort of unsettled by it. It's, I think, a lot better than a lot of mainstream horror, which just made me really disappointed when it didn't quite
get over that final hurdle.
I
wasn't as big a fan of it, I have to admit. I liked it. I think it's fantastically directed. I think it's a wonderful sort of, it'll be a great start of a wonderful career. But part of me was thinking, watching it, that this is basically the prestigious version of The Conjuring. The Conjuring is like nostalgia, horror movie nostalgia repackaged. Horror movie nostalgia repackaged in terms of, and it's funny because people mention The Exorcist in terms of discussions of Hereditary. For me, it was much more what you mentioned, Rosemary's Baby and Don't Look Now, in that like what The Conjuring is to, say, The Exorcist or The Omen or Poltergeist. Amityville is another great influence there. You know, this film, Hereditary, is very much to the more artful side of horror, the sort of existential abstract horror of the 70s. And it's sort of like, it, watching it, a part of me was like, this is just a different form of the same nostalgia. This is just the same form of like, weren't the 70s great in Hollywood? Let's package that. Because I actually, that one moment in the first act that you mentioned, that caught me completely off guard. Because it's a fantastic
moment. It's terrific, and it's very rare to have that kind of experience now.
But that just drove home to me how much of the rest of the film I was going, why the hell haven't the characters copped on to what exactly is going on here? Because I have figured it out from the moment a character goes into a room and looks at a box. I was like, I know exactly where this movie's going because of that kind of film. And it just, it felt very unsurprising. It's a shame to say predictable, but it felt very trite. It felt very cynical to me.
7 minutes.
I think it sustains itself for it.
The atmosphere is fantastic.
I think a big problem is that last act, there's a lot of like, I know this is crazy, but just believe me.
I like the way that it bundles it up in humor a lot of the time.
Yeah,
it kind of tempers it well.
Ronan, you're not allowed to laugh at it. Haven't you read the cinema Twitter rules? Please don't laugh at horror film.
Is it really horror?
Has it not made horror prestigious? Unlike The Exorcist, which was nominated for Best Picture, Silence of the Lambs, which won Best Picture. I mean, if
I can't do
I'm sure there'd probably be someone out there who'd argue with you that Silence of the Lambs is not a horror movie. People are so picky about their definition of horror movies.
It's people
like, Cam,
who really
takes
up themselves and don't like horror who say this. Yeah. You don't because have to excuse liking horror. You can like horror. Horror is great.
Yeah.
I mean, Jaws is a horror movie, right?
Yeah. Jaws has the greatest jump scare in cinema history, as far as I'm concerned. I've seen Jaws about a dozen times, and every time I see it, I scream again.
I'm still utterly astonished by the amount of people, like respected film critics I see on Twitter, who will look you in the eye and say Jaws is not a horror movie. And I'm like, you are a cinematic idiot, and you're being paid to write this shit.
Tell it, Grace.
Why are you like this?
Like, Grace has moved out from the kind of casting shade on real places and has moved on to casting shade on the Twitter sphere. At number one, surprising absolutely nobody, it's Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, J.A. Boyonnaz, a sequel to Jurassic World, directed by Colin Trevorrow, and setting up Jurassic World 3, also directed by Colin Trevorrow.
What a cinematic legacy.
It's no Book of Henry. Book of Henry's amazing.
Have you gone to see it in 4D yet?
Not yet. Stop it, Donegan. Nobody asked you anything yet.
We're working on this.
We'll get there.
We're working on this. You do realize the World Cup means that there's nothing replacing this.
I kind of realized that yesterday. It's nothing's going to be good.
Wouldn't they make a fortune if they showed the World Cup in 4DX?
Yes.
The problem is that you kind of have to time all the
problem is that you don't know what way the match is going to go. Yeah. If you could show like vintage great matches in 4DX. Well,
I mean, surely FIFA.
I would pay to see that.
Surely FIFA could be on top of that. But Jurassic World, I still have a massive soft spot. It's not a good movie, but it's a fun movie because it's Nosferatu, but with dinosaurs.
It cannot possibly be that accomplished. There's just no way.
It is. There's a moment where, obviously, at some point, the Universal Studio executive said, this is going to make $500 million no matter what we do with it. Somebody stuck up their hands and said, gothic horror, but with dinosaurs.
Oh,
and somebody said, I like it, we're sold. Can we do a Looney Tunes scene with Ted Levine? Yeah, let's do that as well. It's stunning. There are moments watching this, and this is interesting when you talk about like Hereditary as a movie that surprised you and caught you off guard. Mm-hmm. Jurassic World, again, while not being a good movie, it's a movie that I never anticipated. I could never see any of the crazy stuff that was happening in it, which is something of itself in this day and age.
That's a welcome change, I suppose, with these films that, as you say, are guaranteed to make incredible amounts of money. Because I just couldn't.
He has too much respect for all your positivity. I'm sure.
I think
it isn't particularly. You aren't compelled to see it by the fact that its predecessor is possibly one of the worst films ever made.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I agree with that.
You wouldn't
really
be running out the door to it now.
Push it.
I didn't see that.
See that? You just
No.
Well, wait. Two.
Everyone has told me not even ironically.
Please see.
Just don't.
Two won't make sense until you see one.
I want you to see United Passions. I don't want you to see Jurassic World.
There you go. That's true care.
That's on my list next. Don't worry. I'll let that. Next week.
All right, so let's move on to talking about the new entries this week. So, out this week is In the Fade, which is Diane Kruger, following the death of her husband and son in a bomb attack. She seeks revenge on those responsible.
I like Diane Kruger, so that sounds up my street.
Did it win the Best Foreign
Language? It won something.
Oscar?
Did it?
I can't remember.
Not an Oscar.
I have a feeling it might have won. Was it at some festival?
No.
I can't remember. We're
well, if you guys can keep stalling for time.
The Guessing Game podcast. Which award did it win?
No, I think a Fantastic Woman won Best Foreign.
Oh, it did, yes. It won a Critics' Choice Award as well. It won the German Film Award for Best Leading Actress. Oh, no, these are nominations. But yeah, it won. Let's see, let's draw up its list of awards and nominations.
By all accounts, quite good.
It won the Best Motion Picture Foreign Language at the Golden Globes. There we go. That's probably it. And obviously at the Broadcast Film Critics Association Awards, it won the Critics' Choice Award as well.
Obviously.
I mean, come on, seriously. All right then. And then other movies out this week, we have The Happy Prince, which myself and Ronan saw.
We did, we went on a date.
It was magical. We almost stole Jim Sheridan's Minstrels.
We did. Where it was in the...
I think Jay approves of that.
Jim would be very cranky about that. Like,
yeah, it was in the Stella, and there were a little table of minstrels behind, and I kept glancing. I quite like those. But it was a reserved area, and then Jim Sheridan sat down and was like, that's why those minstrels are reserved.
You should have grabbed a handful.
It's great, because Ronan doesn't eat popcorn, so I got the whole bucket of popcorn to myself. It was fantastic. Everybody wins, except for Ronan.
Except for me, sitting there listening to Jim Sheridan eating minstrels, watching a film that is less interesting than Jim Sheridan eating minstrels.
Oh!
That was a nice segue. I like that. Yeah, The Happy Prince.
Happy Prince is not good. I had really high hopes for it because I think...
I like Everett.
He's a good performer. I think he hams it up totally here in a way that really kind of ruins things from the get-go. It's a very showy performance, which makes sense with Wilde. Wilde was a performer.
Yeah.
You know, Wilde is often singled out as the first person who was famous for being famous, despite all the writing. His American tour was sort of founded on the fact that he was a celebrity.
A persona.
He was this massive persona. And in that respect, it makes sense to really push him out there, but this was a time in his life when that wasn't necessarily the case. And Everett tries to package that in a way that... You know, it shows
the structuring of the film is
oh, the structure
not
is
good.
A mess, and it keeps doing this thing where it does a sort of slow motion flashback while the audio continues from the present day. It's a complete mess.
This is his first directorial and writing credit on screen, and it kind of shows
really
in some
shows.
Respects.
And it's he's played the character on stage a number of times.
The Judas Kiss, I think, is
and it's clear he has a great affection for it. But he just doesn't know how to tell the story.
I was maybe fonder of his performance than you were, but yeah, the film itself is a mess.
Absolute mess, and in such a way that's a terrible, terrible shame, because you could do something interesting with this, but it falls apart almost immediately, and I sort of sat there for 2 hours just watching it through my
head. I'm not sure there was enough religious symbolism, to be honest. That was my big takeaway from it. I feel like there could have been more scenes that took place in churches.
Yeah, and it's It's just, I don't want to be mean, but I have almost nothing nice to say about it.
All right, on that note, we'll transition and pivot then over to Grace. We saw Ocean's 8, which is releasing this weekend.
What have I done?
We need to throw shade on something else.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to be throwing shade on Ocean's 8 because I really enjoyed it. I thought it's incredibly slight in before everyone starts complaining about that. But I don't know. I don't think it's that dissimilar to previous entries in that franchise in that regard. It's all very kind of light, silly, frothy comedy. And the real charm with a film like this, I think, is just the cast. The cast are brilliant. It's just, it's so nice just to see a group of women like this come together on screen and be allowed to just be glamorous and cool and confident and not, spend time in the finer details and just enjoy being around each other. There's no kind of, there's no romantic subplot. There's no crap about past trauma or any of that shite. It's just... they're just allowed to sort of sashay out of a building and be like, we're going to rob the joint. Yeah, that sounds great. Let's do that. And also Cate Blanchett is just phenomenal in it. She looks like David Bowie reincarnated. Ooh. If you don't have the feels for Cate Blanchett when you come out of this, you may not have a pulse, which is a bit concerning. But it's true. Yeah. I don't make the rules.
The entire ensemble's fantastic and very well cast as well. Sarah Paulson is really good in this as well. Bullock
Sandra
just
Bullock
loses
just
charisma.
Sneers at everyone. It's beautiful. It is beautiful.
And Sandra Bullock sneering sounds right.
I like to imagine that her character in Miss Congeniality just went off the rails at some point and turned into Debbie Ocean.
My issues with it, though, are less that the cast is fantastic, the idea of doing this with a bunch of women is fantastic, and in fact I think the film's exploration of ideas of female friendship is fascinating, and also even the way in which it genders the storytelling conventions in terms of Debbie Ocean's relationship with one of the targets and the marks of this, and obviously the way in which all these different elements interact. The female gaze is quite literally weaponized at several points of the film with a set of glasses that allow characters to see through each other's eyes. It's one of the core storytelling and narrative devices in there, and the weaponization of the Whisper Network and gossip and stuff like that's very, very well done and very timely and all that sort of stuff. The issue with it, though, is less the stuff involving the central actors and the cast. It's more to do with Gary Russell's direction, in that this is a film that is set in New York City. It features the characters planning to rob the Met Ball. It should pop. It should sparkle. It should jump off the screen. It should look like those wonderful shots that Soderbergh did in Las Vegas of the glittering Vegas Strip sort of,
Bellagio films.
Yeah. It should have lots of those shots, and it doesn't really have that. And there's moments there are moments when the character is walking and they look amazing and they're fantastic, but the issue is that Ross doesn't always get the hero shots that you need for this. There's a wonderful moment where before they do the heist, they do the obligatory roll call bit where they call each of the characters and you get to see them, and so it's here's where everybody is before it starts. I mean, it's this great, it's a simple shot. It's you push in down along and you do a roll call as you pass character after character after character. And Ross somehow bungles that to the point where he loses Mindy Kaling in the middle of the crowd. She says, I'm here, and then her face pops in 3 seconds later. It's like, how do you... It looks like a shot he did before he went to lunch. And I mean, it's... sorry, this sounds like I'm being very harsh. I'm not... It is... The cast are fantastic. The dynamic is clever. It's very light. It's very fluffy. It does suffer a little bit from a lack of a strong antagonist. It has three potential antagonists, in that it has Richard Armitage's character, who's responsible for betraying Debbie, sending her to prison, but that's okay. He becomes a mark in the plot, so he has no agency, which is grand. That's a valid decision to make, not to have a male antagonist who serves as a threat. There's also potentially Anne Hathaway's character, who is the target of the heist. They're going to literally rob the diamonds off her neck, but something happens in the third act, which again is justifiable in terms of theme and story, but which undercuts the idea of there being somebody that they're playing against. And then finally, and you guys are going to love this, there's James Corden in the third act.
And Jay is out.
But James Corden is introduced in a scene in which he quite literally explains that he is not a threat to anybody. He's not here to arrest anybody. He doesn't work for law enforcement. All he's concerned with is tidying up the rest of the plot. And I understand why you don't necessarily need a strong antagonist for a story like this, but it seems like when you're watching the characters play, you're watching a competition. You're watching the characters be fantastic and witty and clever and improvisational, and watching them use their ability and their wits to manipulate the system and to come up with this clever plan. but they don't really have anybody playing against them, so it doesn't feel like they're winning in a tangible sense. And it's like one of the more underrated aspects of like the better Ocean's movie. And let's be clear, this is much, much better than Ocean's 12. This is maybe just a little bit not quite as good as Ocean's 13, really? But it's almost. I loved Ocean 13. Ocean 13's
really bad. Larry.
Ocean 13 has Al Pacino and Hua Amod.
Ocean's 11's great.
You said like it's a good
terrible.
But as like the scenery chewing villain who you want to see humiliated, he works okay, quite well. I mean. And so. But yeah, I liked it. I liked it, but it didn't quite click for me.
I should say this is the latest film for which they've done one of those weird go see films in the cinema trailers. Oh. Which yeah, I've got it a few times this week where really?
That's so weird.
It's like Find Your Feet was the last one, wasn't
yeah,
it?
With, yeah, they have the main cast all sitting there going, "What's the best thing about cinemas? Well, it's this, and what's the downside?"
Oh, that's really Morto.
It's very strange, and this is a very
it feels very mean to
the
cast. Yeah, kind
of, they have fun with it. It's kind of snappily edited and everything. But I have to look into who's making these, because it's happened a few times in Irish cinemas lately.
And it now makes me want to watch it on Netflix.
Yeah,
you know that you're going to have
speeding
now
up
promos.
The decline. Yeah,
you're going to have now promos where Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett explain the appeal of watching on Netflix. Once
in
they
fairness,
get to that
the appeal of watching Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett is self-evident.
It is. No, it
you
is.
You really shouldn't have to sell it.
Yeah, yeah. And the movie works very well in those terms. Like again, Kate Blanchett is just amazing. Just watching her. Like, read the newspaper. It would be exciting.
She is to this film what Kate McKinnon was to Ghostbusters.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's not as if, like, the rest of the cast are slouches as well. Rihanna works very well in the role that she's cast in. Awkwafina is very good. Sarah Paulson is criminally underused, but is still fantastic in this. She's amazing as the sort of the mother who basically has this sort of dark secret she keeps from her family, where she has this sort of, you know, a whole warehouse full of fenced materials in mommy's private room, which is just fantastic. Yeah, the subtext is not exactly subtle on that one, but it works very well, and watching them bounce off each other plays very well. And Hathaway is really good as well, as she always is, and there's a sense that she's playing with the idea of her as a celebrity, which is something, because Hathaway obviously has that weird thing where everybody didn't like Hathaway.
I find this kind of curious because I never really saw that persona in Anne Hathaway. Yeah. Other people around her age who would have been really like who would have come out maybe around the same time she did, but I never saw Anne Hathaway that way. But I guess other people did. She's sending up the kind of like thing that you would have expected from like Paris Hilton back in the day, you know, like but. Not from her, unless I just see Anne Hathaway very different.
Well, I think it's also the career orientated, always smiling, always like prim and proper thing, which is again like the thing with Anne Hathaway and the hatred of Anne Hathaway is that like we loved Leonardo DiCaprio for doing exactly what Anne Hathaway did, but more. Like we admire James Franco for not trying while hosting the Oscars. No, I know.
Society.
Yeah. Right. Whereas Anne Hathaway, for some reason, is, you know, and I suspect we know what the reason is.
She's always been great in pretty much everything.
No, she is. She's really good. I mean, Colossal was one of the.
She's really great in Colossal.
Yeah.
I have a lot of problems with that film, but they're all weathered by her mostly.
Yeah. All right. Also out this week is Overboard, the remake of the classic film.
What?
Okay.
is it?
This is the one with Anna Faris and Eva Longoria, John Hannah.
That cast got a cinema release? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's harsh.
Read those names again.
Anna Faris is great. Come on.
Yeah, 15, 20 years ago.
Smiley face.
Have you not seen What's Your Number? She's class in that.
Oh, I haven't seen
Am that. I the only one who's seen What's Your Number? Oh,
I've
my
never
God.
Even heard
people.
Of it. I've never heard
okay,
of it.
Okay, so it's she's in it and Chris Evans pre-Captain America? Maybe around the same time. I don't know. Anyway, Chris Evans is in it. Chris Pratt is in it in a few scenes. It's kind of an ongoing joke. But basically, she has this thing where like she... she was worried that she slept with too many guys, hence the number in the title. So she starts going, and like she's reached her limit, kind of, to be considered respectable. So she goes back through all of the guys that she's previously slept with to figure out which one of them is like the one she's meant to be with. It's I know that makes it sound kind of weird, but it is actually very good. It's very subversive.
I highly recommend Smiley Face, which is a Greg Araki movie that Anna Faris is in, where she just gets high, and it's 90% of the movie is just her high face on the screen. And
I've clearly missed the Anna Faris the last decade.
I'll loan you What's Your Number. I think you'll like it.
Okay.
I love that we were talking about Overboard. It's like, no, watch these other Anna Faris movies instead.
Well, none of us have seen Overboard, so we can't vouch for it.
It's a very strange. Apparently, it's okay is the word that's coming out.
Well, that's great, Darren. It's grand. Two thumbs up, Darren.
Perfectly adequate. And then finally, a movie which I suggest, which may be highly polarizing, the big Irish cinematic release of the week, Kissing Candy, Stephen McArdle's film.
Yes.
Jay, you were a big fan of this when you saw it today.
The thing that it is, like, the things that you, I know you're not a big fan of it, Darren, as such, but I think the things that you kind of probably dislike about it are probably some of the things I like about it, in the sense that I've no real argument that anybody say that there is more style than substance here. I think that's probably fair. I think it's a kind of heightened reality kind of thing going on. There's a lot of Lynch imagery here. Just, no?
There's a lot.
Yeah,
there's
that's
a
okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
There's,
right?
Yeah. There's a lot of Winding Refn. There's a lot of Richard Kelly. There's a lot. There's even a little bit of Christopher Nolan in there, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, but it's, I think she takes influences and references and makes them her own. I don't think it's kind of like she's stealing.
No,
this is... This is very much our own work. Like.
Yeah, no, and then, like, genius steals. Like, it's not an issue with that. Not what I'm complaining about, or not what I object to, if I object to anything in the
it's
film.
It's interesting, though. It's a story about a young guy that kind of goes missing in a small town, kind of border town, I guess, in a kind of... It's not really the time of the Troubles, but it's post-Troubles, but it's not really necessarily in this universe to some degree. It's a heightened environment. Weird version of kind of Lowe's
hyper-stylized, sort of very tense, very abstract.
Yeah. And the main
version of Loud.
A lot of tattoos. Stuff be kicking off in Loud.
And the young girl at the start of it, who kind of has this vision at the start of it, where she dreams about this guy, and then he somehow, or does he become real? It's kind of hard to kind of tell, because she kind of has these fainting kind of seizures, I guess. And so he kind of rescues her at one point from one of them on the road. And so she's kind of identified to you, etc. So he kind of joins her, and it's kind of somewhat of an odyssey to find the kid. And then there's her dad, who's a police officer, who's investigating it. John Lynch is terrific, who usually is very good. He comes kind of involved, and it becomes a kind of Halloween type thing in it. Yeah. So you get all
David Kelly, that's where the David Kelly influence sort of comes in. Where you have this sort of weird heightened Halloween, everybody's wearing costumes, what's going on vibe.
And
it sounds kind of class, lads.
It's visually stunning, and it costs practically very little to make, from what I gather.
Yeah, I think I read an interview with the director, what's her name?
Aoife McArdle.
The other day, where she said that the budget she got for this was less than, I think, than the budget she would have gotten for, like, music videos and stuff she's made
before.
She's
used to working with kind of YouTube money for her videos and stuff, but she obviously knows how to stretch money to make it look well.
Yeah.
I think this is a calling card film to some degree. I think there's a lot of talent there, clear, clear talent, visually and... When she gets the right story, and when she the story there, it's interesting. It goes off course. It's not quite satisfying enough to kind of say what a great film, but it's really good and really interesting. And it's a kind of, I can remember coming out of the cinema after seeing it at ADIF, and thinking, I really, really want to see more of her films. And I hope she makes more of it. And I think she's making a sci-fi film, which is like immense. The worst directors ever make sci-fi films. Like, we've been
Zoran, that's the one. Is it Zoran?
Last Day on Mars, and Space Truckers, who the hell did that? we don't make them. And I know with the visuals in this, and hopefully it's a budget, I can only imagine what work she's going to do.
I'm really looking forward to it. I think it looks terrific, and there's the score in the trailer is really intoxicating.
Yeah, of course,
it's got a fantastic score.
Yeah, the trailer is amazing. I saw it before Hereditary, and it was
I'm really looking forward to see it. I'm going to catch it in Triskel over the weekend down in Cork, one of the great cinemas in this country. But they are also showing it, I think, for a week with Sean O'Connor's Disappearance ahead of it, the short film, did a lot of good business around festivals, got a lot of good word whipped up around it, and that's one thing Triskel is really, really good for doing, is programming Irish films with Irish shorts as a good way to kind of give exposure to Irish shorts, which apart from short screening on Tuesday night in RTE, don't really get much of a chance with audiences outside the festival circuit.
I mean, you just see how this plays though to an Irish audience. I don't know how big they're aiming for, how wide the release is.
I don't know.
I wouldn't imagine it's too wide. I'd imagine it's fairly niche. Mm-hmm. I'd just be interested to see what the audiences think of it.
Art centres and sort of urban centres,
Yeah, I'd like to think people like it to some degree. I think if you go with it, I think, Darren, you're kind of Okay.
I agree with a certain amount of what you said. I think she's a fantastic director, has a wonderful visual eye. I think that there's wonderful ability there. I think that she needs somebody else writing a script. The movie is not very well written, not very well put together. Its choices are obvious at the best of times and befuddling at the worst of times. There is a moment where the characters who are on the run literally seek sanctuary in a church. Yeah. While they are in the church, wait for this, one of the characters then confesses his core and most deeply held secret. He confesses because he's in a church. Because if you're in a church, you confess. But don't worry, in case you didn't get that, after they've had this conversation and after he's done the act of confessing, you then get a shot of him inside a confessional after he's confessed. I really want to go with it. It looks beautiful. It looks lovely. It's got this wonderful neon-drenched cinematography. It's red. It's blue. But it just doesn't. It didn't click for me.
I could sense that off you when you were watching it. It just wasn't kind of.
It reminded me a lot of Lost River, if we're being entirely honest.
Oh, good Lord.
In that it's a lot of, like, you can tell that the influences are great. You can tell that she probably has a better eye than Gosling, but
probably
she the script she has a she doesn't have certainly. As good a script as Gosling, and all Gosling right, didn't have a good script either. But yeah, it's I don't know. I wasn't a big fan.
Yeah, fair.
Cool. All right then.
No one else has seen it.
All right, so take it easy. But in the meantime, if people are looking to find any of our panelists online, where can they find you, Danica?
You can find me on I'm at Film Grabber on Twitter, and check out the site where there's a new movie every day. I've been doing it for 7 years, so come say hi.
You can find me on Twitter at Pixie Grace.
I'm on Twitter at Baron Ronan.
I'll be watching the World Cup. No, I'm on at Jay Coyle on Twitter, but I will be watching the World Cup.
Perfect. And films. You can find me online, @Darren_Mooney. You can on Twitter. You can follow me at the 250, which is the movie podcast that I host for this week. And I feel kind of bad that I've been mean to both Ocean's 8 and possibly the Kissing Candice, because this week I'm talking about Forrest Gump. So anyway, take it easy, guys. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Later.
I never forget the first moment when I walked in, curious cinema. I was hooked from there on.